Welcome to the Chrisman Commentary Daily Mortgage News Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Chrisman. Topics on today's episode include New York City tidbits without any jackhammers like we had yesterday. My interview with Mitchell Sandler's Daniela Caceres on fair lending jurisprudence and proving discrimination based on disparate impact. And are the dog days of summer here already? Thanks to today's podcast sponsor, LoanCare. LoanCare has successfully navigated clients and homeowners through market change for 40 years. The mortgage subservicer is known for delivering superior customer experience through personalization and convenience. Its award-winning portfolio management tool, LoanCare Analytics, supports MSR investors with a focus on customer engagement, liquidity, and credit risk. LoanCare is part of Fidelity National Financial, a Fortune 500 company, and leading provider of services to real estate and mortgage industries. Attendees are gearing up for the upcoming NBA secondary conference in Manhattan, which basketball fans know it as the home of Madison Square Garden and are hoping for the Knicks to play the Celtics during the conference. Manhattan is also the home of Central Park. The park, with some nice walks and runs, is large, but not even in the top 100 in terms of acreage of city parks in the United States. Speaking of outdoors and parks, the other day, my dad and sister took my niece Cosette to a much smaller park with a pond to feed the ducks. Just as they were breaking out some day-old Wonder Bread, a woman commented, "Bread is one of the worst things you can feed ducks." So they gave the ducks some leftover foie gras. Okay, just kidding. About some mortgage stuff. It has been a really strong purchase year-to-date as we move through spring home buying season. Inventory is up, housing values are strong, and there's a lot of demand in the market. In fact, Optimal Blue's April Originations Market Monitor report showed that mortgage purchase lock counts rose year over year for the first time since the Fed began rate hikes 2 years ago. The 5% annual increase in mortgage lock counts is encouraging because lock count controls for home prices and are less volatile than rate-driven refi activity. That is despite the 30-year conforming fixed rate rising 51 basis points in April to finish the month at 7.24%, 80 basis points higher than 1 year ago. Total rate lock volume increased by 8.7% month over month, driven by an 11.0% month over month increase in purchase lock volume. Non-conforming loan products, including jumbo and non-QM loans, increased their market share by 1.85% to 13.7%. Meanwhile, shares for conforming, FHA, and VA loans declined. Overall purchase volume is expected to remain strong through the second and third quarters. For today's interview, I want to welcome to the show Mitchell Sandler's Daniela Caceres to talk about fair lending jurisprudence and proving discrimination based on disparate impact. She's a partner and head of the Mortgage Regulatory Practice Group at Mitchell Sandler, and her specialties include regulatory compliance, litigation and enforcement, mortgage regulations, and fair lending.
I want to wish you happy belated Mother's Day. You are a mother. How'd you spend the day? How'd you celebrate?
Thank you. We went to brunch and I got to sleep in and watch some tennis. That's what I like to do with my mornings if I can get it.
So you recently wrote an article about fair lending, which these are my words, not yours. It was groundbreaking on some level because it challenged the orthodoxy of fair lending jurisprudence generally. And I guess I'll ask you to summarize the article a little bit for listeners here, but I want to ask if in the article, your general thesis was that disparate impact is kind of BS, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. So first of all, I was quoted in the article. I was definitely interviewed, but I didn't write the article. National Mortgage News did, and they did a great job. So I don't want to take credit where it's not due to me. But yeah, so I mean, look, disparate impact is a theory under the Fair Housing Act. There is case law supporting it. I think the issue is that when we're talking about redlining, right, particularly like in my case, I represent a lot of independent mortgage companies. And when you're talking about proving redlining under a theory of disparate impact, at a minimum, you need to prove that the company had an actual policy or practice. And then you need to prove that that policy or practice directly resulted in an adverse effect of basically making loans unavailable. And what you find with independent mortgage companies, right, is often the case, what's revealed through these investigations that precede the settlements or the litigation, if there is any, is that they actually, there was no policy or practice or strategy. Instead, I found that the agencies make arguments based on a lot of circumstantial evidence, right? Like, and I can give you some examples of some of that circumstantial evidence, but at a, you know, bottom line is, like, for example, you have no marketing policy. A lot of mortgage companies that are independent have no marketing policy or corporate direction on where to market or how to market, right? They leave it up to their big producing loan officers to determine, or really even their low producing loan officers to determine how they want to market, how they want to reach out to their referral sources. They're not setting that strategy for the LOs. So, you know, when you get that through an investigation, right, like if it reveals that there's no actual policy or practice regarding marketing, then it's going to be very difficult to prove disparate impact under the Fair Housing Act, because what you actually just proved is there is no marketing or policy. And sometimes, you know, the investigation, you know, the final letters in some of these investigations actually say that, but then also try to make a case for intentional redlining. And so I think they're just the theory that's contradictory to the theory of disparate impact, where you actually have to prove that there's a policy or a practice in place in order to, you know, bring a case that that policy then had a disproportionate adverse impact.
And I'm realizing maybe I should bifurcate the way I ask this next question, because I was going to ask if you believe that one can prove discrimination based on disparate impact, but I want to separate that into, do you, Daniela, believe that one can prove discrimination based on disparate impact, versus do you think that our legal system as currently constituted, or the CFPB as currently constituted, believes that one can prove discrimination based on disparate impact?
I think you could prove a case of discrimination based on disparate impact. I just think it's going to be very difficult to do it, particularly when you're talking about, you know, a independent mortgage company that's not a bank, that doesn't dictate how its mortgage lending practices, you know, how its loan officers really operate, right? Gives a lot of slack, doesn't really set strategy about where they put branches. You know, they're not a depository institution that in a lot of cases is much more organized. They have meeting minutes about decisions about where to open branches and, you know, who to recruit. You'll find with an independent mortgage company, you don't have a lot of that, right? And so there's been a lot of, you know, redlining precedent in the bank space. But more recently, we've seen them, you know, try to inch into the independent mortgage company space to allege redlining. And I think it's very difficult to do that, much more so to use disparate impact to prove redlining for independent mortgage companies.
Well, I want to dive into that slightly. Do you think that there needs to be intent to discriminate shown, or is disparate impact as kind of a baseline all that's really needed to prove past discrimination?
I think you use the disparate impact to prove intent, right? Under the Fair Housing Act. If you're talking about the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, that is a disparate treatment theory. It's not disparate impact. And, you know, that's the land of the CFPB. They can bring ACOA claims. And under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, you know, I can quote you CFPB supervisory highlights where that is a disparate treatment theory and you don't use disparate impact. But under the Fair Housing Act, you know, I do believe that you can bring a case under disparate impact theory for fair lending matters to prove discrimination.
And this might be a good time to ask, why hasn't anybody really challenged the Justice Department or the CFPB on these issues? I guess aside from Townstone, which seems very narrowly limited in scope, but there haven't been a lot of other challenges, have there?
Yeah, no, I mean, there really haven't. I mean, in the independent mortgage company space, the Trident Mortgage settlement is the only precedent, right? And that was a company that was, you know, selling to Berkshire Hathaway. So in that case, it was Berkshire Hathaway's, you know, decision whether or not to settle. And obviously, we don't need to talk about the deep pockets, right? But you know, now we're coming up to a lot of investigations that are coming to a head that, you know, have been going on for years in the independent mortgage company space, right? And we will start to see whether or not mortgage companies decide to challenge the DOJ and the CFPB. You know, I think it's no secret that, you know, there's been a lot of talk, and I've certainly seen it, that redlining enforcement has become a lot more aggressive, both from the DOJ and the CFPB. We're seeing a ton more referrals to the DOJ. And so based on the terms that are proposed, I think mortgage companies are going to have to make a really hard decision about whether or not, you know, they want to fight it, or potentially have to pay, you know, a very large sum of money, even if it is to a loan subsidy fund. But I think, you know, historically, you know, perhaps it was the people that were in a position to settle, right? Like in Trident, they were selling to Berkshire Hathaway. And then also just the very plain idea that, you know, litigating against the Department of Justice, the United States, is daunting, particularly for, like, you know, a non-depository mortgage lender. So overall, it's not an appealing proposition to litigate against the United States and their resources.
Certainly. If the Rich Cordray era was known for kind of shoot first and ask questions later, and the Kathy Kraninger era was known for, hey, let's try and not bring litigation about in these actions or these orders, how would you characterize the Chopra era at the CFPB?
I think even in the face of, you know, federal courts that have, you know, come down on them, you know, and not ruled in their favor, right? Like in the Seventh Circuit with the Townstone case, I am seeing that they are just as aggressive, if not more aggressive, in bringing cases, even under ACOA, which is the same, you know, set of laws that Townstone was brought under, right? Which failed or thus far. I am seeing them, if not as aggressive, even more aggressive, even after, you know, the decision in the Seventh Circuit that ruled against them. So, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, you know, going back to when Rich Cordray was at the helm, you know, I don't know that I would say it's as aggressive. I think, you know, obviously there are different areas that the agencies are focusing on, but I would say it is an extremely aggressive environment when you're talking about redlining reviews.
So do you believe that the Supreme Court's ruling on the CFPB's funding authority, whether they say it's constitutional or unconstitutional, or they kind of revise the structure of funding, will that have an impact on the way the CFPB litigates or the aggressiveness which you believe that they will litigate?
I don't believe so. Like I said, there's a lot more referrals to the Department of Justice right now than I've ever really seen, you know, resulting out of CFPB investigations or exams. And so, you know, I think they're using joint resources. And I don't necessarily see a slowdown in how aggressive the CFPB is in bringing these matters.
Before I let you go, any other news surrounding RESPA, fair lending, anything that's kind of top of mind for clients right now that you think is worth the listeners knowing here?
Appraisal bias is something that's coming up more and more in the news. There are quite a few cases going on, you know, sort of across the country, but most recently there was the Loan Depot settlement, which kind of brought to the attention that mortgage companies are being held responsible, unfortunately, for a lot of, you know, they're being held responsible for managing appraisal bias, right? You know, at these appraisal management companies or what appraisers they're using. And so I just think that mortgage companies need to be thinking about what processes they can put in place to monitor their AMCs or their appraisers to make sure that, you know, they're not exposed to either a, you know, consumer lawsuit or, you know, an investigation that could lead to a costly either litigation or settlement.
Very well put. And for fans of Daniela Caceres, of which I told you I am one, where will she be in the coming months? Are you speaking anywhere soon? Are you plans to be at conferences? What's your travel schedule like?
Yeah, I will be at the NAMBA Fair Lending Conference. And I expect I'll be at the regulatory conference. I think the next big fair lending one is NAMBA in August. So you all can see me there.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it as always.
Thanks, Robbie.
Much like most days of late, there was little in the way of market-moving news yesterday. And unlike most days of late, there was no supply from the Treasury to help dictate market direction. In lieu of much going on, investors were able to focus on what has so far been a disappointing corporate earnings season. The New York Fed's latest survey of consumer expectations showed an increase in year-ahead inflation expectations to 3.3% from 3.0%. Well, the three-year outlook dipped to 2.8% from 2.9%. And the five-year outlook rose to 2.8% from 2.6%. On a macro scale, a softening labor market has reignited hopes that the current restrictive rate environment is having the desired effect. And the Fed will be able to cut rates multiple times later in the year. Today brings this week's first big inflation report with April producer prices. PPI came in up 0.5% and up 2.2% year over year. Excluding food and energy, up 0.4%, versus expectations for increases of 0.3% month over month in both the headline and excluding food and energy, which is not good that it's exceeded expectations. Before PPI, NFIB Small Business Optimism for April was released, rising for the first time in several months when it was seen declining. Later today brings Redbook same-store sales, some short-duration treasury auctions, and remarks from a couple of Fed speakers. We begin the day with agency MBS prices worse about an eighth from Monday's close, and the 10-year yielding 4.52 after closing yesterday at 4.48%. The 2 years up to 4.89%. Let's wrap up with a joke and some housekeeping. Don't you agree flip phones were so much more satisfying for ending annoying conversations? Thanks again to LoanCare. The mortgage subservicer is known for delivering superior customer experience through personalization and convenience. Its award-winning portfolio management tool, LoanCare Analytics, supports MSR investors with a focus on customer engagement, liquidity, and credit risk.
If you have any questions about the podcast or sponsoring opportunities, send me an email at robbie@robchrisman.com. Visit robchrisman.com for more information on our industry partners, access to archived commentaries, and how to subscribe to the daily mortgage news and commentary. To listen to or download past episodes of this podcast, search Mortgage News on any platform you get your podcast from.